So this is the first installment in what I think I'm going to choose to call the Gingerbread Man's TV show. Not TV show. I'm stoned. I'm going to hit my bong again. Hi, introduce yourself, please.
Hi, my name is Calvin. I'm a really good longtime friend of Brandon. We're just smoking pot, and I think we're about to talk about the Kabbalah.
That sounds pretty great. This is fun. All right, so do you know anything about Kabbalah at all?
Is it like a holy reference?
So it's considered a type of mysticism. So it's of a religious context. So there's a lot of different types of mystics because there's different variances of extremes in any religion. Like, for instance, the Southern Baptists are pretty extreme for Protestants, even though not all Protestants are out, you know, being mad at people and claiming that they have baby blood all over them, you know? So mysticism is one of those, it's kind of like the like more occultic sects of certain religions. Like, there's this guy named Meister Eckhart who is really, really good at doing a lot of writing. I know that's really compelling. But he just had this weird take on a lot of things. So, for instance, one of the first things in that book, which is a very introductory text, and it doesn't even have authors, which I don't really like. I want to get some more texts that have writings by people that are more primary source. This is more like some guy put together some ideas. But it's still cool because I don't know anything about it. And it's really, really small. And I was listening to another person talking about the idea itself. And that person, in fact, claimed that most people who really look into Kabbalah, so to put a little bit more onto it, it's a sect of Judaism. So Kabbalah started in Judaic schools, but they say like, but there are also Kabbalic Christians, but those are a lot less common. But the Kabbalic Christians got their ideas from the Kabbalic Jews, and the Kabbalic Jews most likely got a lot of their ideas from interacting with Easterners and having interactions with, you know, China and with India, and the blending of ideals coming together. And so it's just this really beautiful kind of look at a kind of way. And so, for instance, one of the things in the beginning of that one, this guy was talking about, like, you know, there's a word that the world that's coming to you is a word that's used, or a kind of phrase. And it can be said a lot of different ways, like the world that's coming or the world that's promised, you know, like that certain phrasing is used often in a lot of these texts, especially in like the first five Masoretic books, like in the Torah, which would be Genesis, Exodus, Deuteronomy, Numbers, and Leviticus. And those are the book of laws. And, you know, those are the first five Masoretic books that have to do with Moses and the Israelites. So, like, it often promises these guys where it sounds almost like God is promising the future to the Israelites, you know, and he promises Israel itself, but in a lot of these ways it could be taken a different way. Like, the world that's coming could be the world that's promised to you as the Israelites, which is kind of that holy sacrament that they were promised. But like, some of the Kabbalic writers took that phrasing as the world that's coming, as in, we are here in this moment right now, and every time we ascend into a new moment, every time we make a choice, and every time we breathe, and every time we go into the next moment, the world that's coming is the world that's coming upon you. So it's the act of happening. It's not the world that's promised. It's not a future thought. The world that's coming is the actual action of presentness and experiencing the moment coming to you.
It's the one thing that's constant. Attending
it. And that being the essence of God is one of the essences of Ein Sof, which Ein Sof would be God. It's the essential nothingness, and that's where all of creation emanates from, is the Ein Sof, which is another way of thinking of God, at least in the Kabbalic ideas. You know, like, what do you think?
Very interesting.
It's real weird.
So the only thing constant, the world that's coming, is the here and now.
Yeah.
Change will happen, but when it happens, it's going to be then's here and now.
Mm-hmm. And any forethought about anything, you know, which is kind of like a really good idea that I like in a lot of these philosophies that you especially see in Eastern philosophy too. You know, you ever heard of Eckhart Tolle?
I've just the name.
Yeah, he basically just says, you know, focus on what's happening right now. You know, and like Ram Dass said it too. He had a book called Be Here Now. And, you know, if you really dig into almost any sort of philosophical ideologies, you know, these people, usually at the heart of all peace comes into, you know, like, don't focus on your ability to think you can forecast. like the idea of forecasting itself, that's probably going to sound fantastic because she's so fucking loud and old. Justin's not home yet. I'm sorry. But yeah, I like it. And I preach it too. It's really simple. And it started for me with mindfulness. Do you know anything about mindfulness? Or the idea of mindfulness?
Just little bits. Like,
well, tell me. Give me your bits.
Being present in the moment, but also being really aware of what you're doing in that moment is mindfulness. Attentive. Is being attentive to yourself and your surroundings.
Even when it's uncomfortable. Like being like, wow, I'm really stressed right now and I'm being really abrasive, but I'm looking at it, you know, like looking at that feeling. Like that's especially what I think of as mindfulness. And like presentness is the heart of it because it's easy to escape that moment and it's really hard to hold on to it. Like, have you ever tried watching your breath? Is one of those weird Buddhist kind of ideas. Like, have you ever heard of that? Just to attentively watch your breath and not count it. Not going 1, 2, 3, but just to notice, like, I'm breathing in, but not really even saying it. Just having that, kind of like being at the gates of your airways, and you can feel that gate and like in, out, and just watch it and see how long you can do it. And like, often you can't really do it for that long. It takes practice. It's hard. You know, you all of a sudden you'll take like 5 or 10 breaths and I'll be like, oh, I know what I want to work on. I want to make that black or green or blue, or I want to cook this tonight. How am I going to get home? You know, and then all of a sudden you're like, fuck, I forgot my breath. You know, like, and that's the heart of mindfulness, is how difficult it is. And when you really start to like watch your breath all the time, you notice, you start to be more attentive to how much worse you feel sometimes too. Because a lot of the times we distract ourselves from our intentions with thoughts and with ideas, you know, and that's like outside of what's going on. It's forecasting.
But you can notice your breath, be it like, okay, it's at this certain pace, I'm really stressed, I need to calm down. Or you can watch your breath be like, I'm really bored, I need to do something.
And when you're really stressed and you breathe and you watch your breath,
you can slow it down and change your stress.
It pulls you out of forecasting for a second, which is sometimes all you got to do. Because nothing's happening in the now. Nothing's ever happening right now.
Stress is always what just happened that I'm still thinking of.
Mm-hmm. And even in a crisis, like even when you have a crisis, you know, the crisis is over really quickly. And often when you've even noticed you're in a crisis is after the crisis has happened. So indeed. When you even notice the crisis, nothing is happening. You might be dealing with the aftermath of the circumstances, but the crisis is already passed. You know, like, so when you really look at the now moment, nothing's really ever happening until you choose to do actions. And that's the world that continues to come. And that's the idea behind the emanation of Ein Sof, which I just find really beautiful in Kabbalah.
That is, man.
It's just a weird twist on it, you know? Like, Judaism has entrapped me. I want to go to a temple, and I have no intentions of believing in God. I'm still a firm agnostic on it. But I really intently feel like I want to go sit through a temple service or a couple and start talking to rabbis. I've already been listening to a couple shows run by rabbis, and the Judaic, the Torah over the Bible, because I grew up in the South. You know, I grew up in a place where you had to be religious or else you were part of the minority. And so that is a strong influence on anybody, even when you're a child, is the minority aspect. And I've embraced it as an adult, and I don't care. And if anything, I would always want to be like that singular person that has ideas that are radically different than anybody else's. That's the kind of place I'd want to be. But as a child, it's harder to pick that disposition, especially when you're trying to fit in. You know, and religion itself, like, so I sat through churches all throughout my childhood. My grandparents are highly religious. My father is not, because of my grandparents. He chose the opposite, because that's how things often go. Maybe this is my opposition to him, is not being a strict atheist, you know? But, like, so I'm very familiar with the way that the Bible interprets the first 5 books, but reading the Torah was excellent, because there's all kinds of different translations and wordings that are incredibly different. Like, in the Bible, it says on the first day, and in the Torah, it says on a day, you know, on a day God got up and started the planet, not on the first day. You know, which leaves a lot of room for interpretations. And Judaic books are less translated. They're a lot more obscure. It's a much smaller religion. And so the books themselves, even though they're the reference material used for all three of the three big ones, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, you know, like, every time you translate a page, it's like playing telephone. You know, it's like passing on a message from one person's ear to another. And every time you translate, it's impossible for the translator not to put his or her own voice or effort into the translation. And that's why I've heard translation called one of the most beautiful arts on the planet. And it's such a huge pedestal to pass on to somebody, because you are doing this egregious effort to take somebody's work that is impossible. It is physically impossible to turn one language into another. You can get close and you can get the essence, and a really good translator makes it beautiful, so that when you read the work, you get this feeling in your chest like, oh, this was close. You know, but it's still, it's always at the back of my head, is like, I'll never get to it until I could actually read the base translation in my own. And so straight off the bat, looking at the Torah's last translation was like 1500s, 1600s, 1700s usually. And you know, most King James books have been retranslated so many times, you have no idea. In fact, King James in the 1750s took out, I think it was like an estimated 30 or 40 books from the Bible that people just don't even know exist and don't have access to, you know, and that's part of their religion. And it's just, that's like, it's base material, but it gets convoluted, you know?
Well, with translating anything, let's say it's a piece of music, is as soon as you change the words, the melody loses its flow.
Mm-hmm. Or like rapping, like when you hear like other languages rap, like,
yeah,
which is really cool. But let's see here. Let's do a diagram. So I find this really pretty. I'll show you a picture too. So this is the Kabbalic Tree of Life. And I can give you a base description. I'm really not a really good source on this. I can only tell you it's very obscure. So basically, Ein Sof is the nothingness that emanates from outside, like outside of everything. And so that's why there's a funnel here, but that's nothingness, like complete lack of form. And there's this really weird theory I read about where this guy named Moshel, who was like this rabbi back in like the early 40s, 1940s or some shit, he had this idea called withdrawal. And he said that the beginning of the universe happened because Ein Sof existed in nothingness. God is everything, because we all emanate from Ein Sof. So every bit of creation is God within Kabbalah, you know. So there is, you're God. Every cell in your body is a piece of God. And God has absolutely no sentience in Kabbalah. And I'll find something in here that's really pretty too, maybe, if I can remember. So Ein Sof emanates into Keter. Keter emanates into the masculine and the feminine, which is Bina and Chokmah. And then they emanate, and every single connection, when you trace the connections, everything is connected. Everything flows from like these main triangles. Like, it's really bizarre. And then, so it emanates through all these essences of God. The Sephiroth are the essences of Ein Sof. So you have, you know, splendor, eternity, beauty. Tiferet is like the king, basically. It's the essence of humanity. Like the heart of, it's a hard concept, but it's really important. It's very obscure. Power, love, wisdom, understanding. It's the idea that all these essences are part of Ein Sof. They emanate from nothingness, but this is the route of nothingness to being. And how, I was just reading about this earlier. So like how like, so when nothingness is in a state of nothingness, it's being nothing. So nothingness is being, even though it's being nothing. And when being is in a state of being, like we were talking about earlier, when you're in the now, nothing's ever really happening. When being is strictly being, when you're in the essence of being right here, nothing is really happening. So like nothing and being are the same. And this is the essence of how God emanates into it, is through beauty and through love and through eternity, which is generation, you know, like it's this
really, I've always had this thought, nothing doesn't really exist because even nothing is something measurable.
If we can conceive of nothing, which I'm not sure we can, at least on the material world. I think we've sensed it in our psychedelic dalliances. I think we've glimpsed little glimpses of nothing. But when, maybe sometimes when I meditate, sometimes maybe we're like, I don't know. But when you're really bound to thinking, like, it's really hard to conceive of what nothing is, because can you really think of what nothing is? Like, you conceive of nothing existing? Like, so even if you have boundaries to your nothing, that's not nothing. Like, nothing is an incredibly, it's like eternity. Eternity is really hard to think of. Like, even big numbers are hard to conceive. But when we really try to wrap our brain around eternity, it's really hard to think about how big that is and how vast eternity is. And a lot of people doubt it. Like, a lot of mathematicians, like a lot of people say mathematics proves that eternity exists. But how can you really do it? There has to be a boundary to the universe, you know? And then there's the multiverse theories where there's a bunch of bubbles of universes, you know? Like, nothing is weird, you know? Like, much like when they label God as nothing, that really appeals to me because it's one of those things that, like, I feel like in those intense journeys, like at the heart of the bottom of a mushroom, you feel that essence where you flip for a second, it's just pure beauty, and you're just like, wow. And it's just like everything is stopping, and like you might have beautiful things happening, and sometimes the beautiful things even disappear because you're just in the state of just like pure awe. And I feel that's the essence of nothing, you know?
I think I may have felt something close to it before. I was coming down off a trip and I started like feeling like parts of myself were assembling from just a void. Out of something that I could not see or feel.
Because it was nothing.
That's crazy, right? Man.
It's one of those things. So I'll show you a picture because it's artsy. I put it on my Facebook, so you might have seen it. I was hoping you would have. It's this beautiful artist. Her name's Leonora Carrington. And if I can remember a brief history, I'll try to give you a little synopsis. She was a British artist, real pretty, I think in the early 1900s or something. And she had quite a few husbands and sounded like she was a partier. It sounded like she lived her life very well. She ended up going on through many countries. Divorced some husband, ended up in Mexico, and so a lot of her work, she's labeled as a Mexican British artist, and she died in Mexico. But she was really heavy with like the psychedelic scene, and she was really heavy into Kabbalah, and she was into like, have you ever heard of Carlos Castaneda? So,
I think so.
He was a really good reporter who went down and found a shaman. There's lots of Mexican shamanism going back to the beginning of time, and all throughout South America. Not to say it's Mexican, it's shamanism in general, which is worldwide. But, like, so she was heavy into that scene because in the 50s, lots of scientists and psychologists and ethnobotanists were going down into South America because there's just troves of plant life that is just, a lot of it has benefits, say to say. A lot of it happens to be psychedelic. And so I have a feeling she was probably part of that crowd. And her art is just absolutely beautiful. And I want to try to buy it soon. But you tell me what you think of this picture when I get it loaded. It reminds me of some of your stuff too. I'll show you another one that's right next to this one that reminds me of your stuff heavily, actually. Calvin is an amazing artist, by the way. If anybody ever ends up listening to this one, he's absolutely an amazing artist. And my phone is shit. Load. Maybe Facebook will work better. But side story to this, I didn't even notice the relevance that I established to this picture until way after I saw it. I am way too active on social media. It's okay. I don't post any bullshit, do I, Calvin?
No.
Oh, it stopped. It bottomed out. It bottomed out. My phone won't load it. Oh, there it is. Yep, Facebook loaded it. Look at this picture, Calvin. What do you think of that? Do you see the Tree of Life? I'm going to just show you in the book.
That is definitely it, man.
Keter, the emanation of being from nothing. And that's Ein Sof, which is nothingness, which is like way in the back. And then there's the triangles. Hakmad Binah, you know. Hesad, Yesad, whatever, and then Mukmat, which is where eternity comes from, which is all of life and all of creation. And when you zoom in here, there's the good and the bad. There's all kinds of shit stung in here. All over the place, there's symbols. And I can buy it for $30. I can put a print on my wall. I think it'd be really pretty.
Well, she definitely has something going, man. She is in touch with just something spiritual.
It's intriguing, and this sect of mysticism in general is just captivating for me. Just absolutely captivating. But anyways, I want to explain that. I started telling a story and then I forgot it. The idea of this guy named Moshele is called withdrawal. So you have this essential nothingness, which is an eternity of nothingness with no boundary, which is, I feel, is almost inconceivable. I don't think I can conceive of it. I'm just essential nothingness. And then Ein Sof had some reason to want, maybe didn't have want, if it has any desire, because there's a, yeah, anyways, I digress again. But basically he clenched in. He, it, she clenched in, and there's this eternal nothingness, and then a bubble of something clenched within the nothing, because Ein Sof withdrew its nothingness and allowed something to come into being. And emanating from nothing emanated all of the essences of creation through the Sephiroth, which is, you know, beauty, love, understanding, wisdom, you know, and all these things that life takes up upon. And, you know, you see the idea of beauty is inherent everywhere. The idea of love is cross species, you know. The idea of wisdom can be seen even in the way that termites build their incredibly complex dens that acoustical scientists are now looking at and trying to study how they make these places, because they can't even build rooms that can resonate that well. My very old house. Okay, buddy. That's really cool, dude. I'm recording. I love you. But, yeah. Maybe I can read a little bit of this shit. How does that make you feel?
I always think that there are a lot of things that humans aren't tapped into, like the, like, sacred geometry. Bees, any bee on the planet is always going to make a perfect hexagon in its hive. And most humans nowadays can't use a hammer and nail to build their own house.
Mm-hmm. Well, we don't have to anymore.
Exactly.
We used to be really good at it. When you think about the Romans, do you know some of the feats they did? Like, wow, the Romans, when they went after Germany, there's a big-ass river between the mainland of Europe and Asia, kind of. And, like, maybe it wasn't the Romans. Maybe I'm quoting wrong. But I'm pretty sure it was the Romans, because they built a series of rafts. They built a raft bridge across this incredibly viscous river that's, like really violent. And, like, they built a raft bridge across it in 2 days that they were able to transport elephants. Maybe it was Alexander the Great, you know, but you think back, though, just because we could doesn't mean we can't. It's just because we aren't.
Yeah.
You know, don't doubt our species. Like, there's a, like, well, I guess that's kind of what you're saying, but yeah. Like, I think if we were really pushed to it, you'd be surprised, especially you, with your woodworking skills. And you're, like, you would, I think if you were put into a situation, I think you'd be surprised what you'd be able to create, even in a survival situation, you know?
There was this one time I was staying at a hotel, and across the parking lot from it was just this massive acreage of these perfectly straight trees. And I was just coming up in my head with this way to build a cabin out of them, and all these ideas made perfect sense. Like, I probably could build people a cabin if the apocalypse happened.
If you had to, I'm sure you could. Might, with some trial and error. Maybe your first cabin would be a little shoddy, but your second cabin would be very nice. Mm-hmm. And you could probably play it. There would be strings embedded in the walls. So while you took a shit, you could, like, harmonize yourself. Sorry, is that too gross? I'm looking for this. No, I like that, though. There's definitely things that we... I think it's essential to always maintain that feeling, you know? That there's something more, and that we never completely understand what we think we understand. Like, that's never a given. Like, why would that be a given? You know? Even science. Like, I will respect science as long as they have a disclaimer, you know? I'm completely fine with disclaimic science, where it's like, hey, just so you know, we could be wrong, but this is what it looks like. That's fine. Mm-hmm. 100% fine. Just don't claim prediction. And if you're a reasonable person, don't claim what you're reading from science as prediction. You know, like, I would always conceive of it just like we're conceiving of the Sephiroth. I think that a lot of scientific claims are just as relevant as these Sephirotic claims, you know, like, and like, some of them might be just like, maybe it's not as pragmatically useful to be like, oh, beauty's in everything, man. you know, and be a hippie about it, but maybe throughout your life, you know, embracing beauty and saying this is part of what I find is mystical, and whether that's God or whether that's just what I think of as the mystical, you know, like that's still really beautiful and that brings a lot of value to my life, just like the ability to build a cabin. It's just as relevant. And why can't it be just as relevant? You know, I'm not saying that building a cabin isn't great. I'm not saying that science isn't great. But why can't that be a really even playing field? You know, at least within the realms of belief as us little measly humans, because we're not building rockets, right?
Because people like to compare beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Why?
I don't know. There's just something in humans that always says they're the best.
Why?
I'm not sure exactly, but my friend Austin was talking about how humans are very competitive with how much they know, whereas animals are not, because animals don't really have subjects to talk about.
I disagree. Look at orcas. Look at elephants. I think they speak. So they were even looking at plants and the shape of flowers, and a lot of people thought that the shape of flowers was strictly to be a physical attribute to say it's a pretty flower, come land on me. But they actually turn out to be acoustically amazing, and they're really good at capturing sounds, just like an ear. Okay. Which means that when a flower's out, it could also be listening. And if it's listening, what is it listening for? And how is it going to react to those perceptions? If it's perceiving anything, is it going to have a reaction to those perceptions? And even if it doesn't have words to describe that, is that a thought? Or is that a feeling about it? You know? Like, and even plants themselves. So there's mycelial connections between trees that interweave the roots of different trees together through these mycelial colonies, which mycelial colonies are fungal colonies, kind of like the bodies of these mushrooms, right? Like that, not the actual mushroom that you eat, but like the mushroom that's underground, it looks like a fuzz. That's a mycelial colony. Maybe not, I'm not talking down to you, but just in case anybody who ever listens in the future. So these colonies connect the trees together, and they transport food and they transport chemical signals from tree to tree. And there's even been instances where an aspen has been scarred in a forest, and it'll release a sap that's toxic so that anything else that tries to attack it could get sick or at least get a bitter taste in it, in case it's like a deer rutting with its horns or something. If it scars it and it gets that bitterness, it'll be averse to it, you know? And there's been instances of other trees 100 or so meters away letting out the sap, you know, almost like there was a communication, say, hey, there's danger.
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying there isn't communication between other things. I'm saying ours is way different because one person will have a belief and the other person will have a different belief, and that person will be like, I'm better than you because my belief is different.
So here's my idea to that. So orcas. So I just watched this excellent documentary. It was called The Whale That Ate Jaws. It's available on Hulu. It's fucking fantastic. But basically these orcas were attacking whales. No. The orcas were attacking great white sharks, like big-ass white sharks. And that's still an imposing predator even for a killer whale, even though killer whales are pretty big. And so they'll attack it in groups. And what they were doing is they were taking down these great white sharks, and they were taking their livers out and then exclusively eating their livers and then leaving them on the floor. And then they were only doing it in this one region, and they'd never been witnessed doing this ever before. And then it happened in this one place, and then the individuals, the group that was doing it, was recorded doing it over and over again. And then somehow the behavior got transported to South America, or South Africa, which is on the other side of the planet. The behavior got translated, and a lot of the scientific disposition was that the orca somehow had a communication or a relation, traveled to that area, did it there, was witnessed doing it, or had a child that left the pod and migrated to a new pod and took that information with it, you know? Like, and it when I really break it down, how could I ever say those animals don't have some complex lifestyle, and like how different we are, you know? Like, maybe. And so my point though is that there's orcas, at least in this documentary, it claimed that various groups of orcas in different locations would have different eating patterns, and they'd have different ways about going about taking out prey. and that all of their methods were observational. And so when they'd have contact with other pods, they would teach other pods, and they would teach their young. And so a lot of this behavior, they think, was that, so when you hold a shark upside down, they basically go to sleep. There's mm-hmm. this neurological response where the shark basically shuts the fuck down. And so the idea that one of these scientists put out was that one of these orcas happened to, was either trying to get away or at least injure it to not fuck it up, or maybe was hungry, battened it upside down, noticed that it fell asleep, and then noticed that if it held it there, it didn't have to work that hard and it would die. And then the shark liver is an incredibly nutrition food, and then it was very easy just to take this incredibly gigantic food source and just have it really easily, just because all they had to do was hold it upside down. And that's why there's very little bite marks on these carcasses. But there was surgical precision with how they took these livers out. Like they like cut them, you know, with their teeth. They like cut little slivers and like slurp. The word used was they slurped the liver out like a straw. You know, like how the fuck do you do that? You know, and then you look at elephants. And I'm not arguing that we're not different. I'm saying that the playing field could be very level. You know, and that there's a lot of differences, but every single creature has this really intense, weird, subjective life going on. You know, like, does that make any sense?
Yeah, we're not different from any other animal. It's just that our society is.
Yeah, or our idea is that we have to be societized. Which I don't think is necessary.
I don't view myself as part of society. I view all friends and family as an extension of my reality and not part of the society, I fear.
I am myself. I am completely my own, and all of my beliefs are completely autonomous and have complete solidarity. I interact with various individuals in various systems, but I am not part of society. You know, but at the same time, I'm going to go start a commune one day, and I might live in the middle of the mountains in my own sovereign nation, but I'm going to raise my son here because that's where all the people are, and it works for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say that's bad. It's hard for me, and I think it's hard for a lot of people. I think a lot of people are starting to realize now that it's uncomfortable to live in these artificial systems because there's nothing real or normal about it. All of this reasonable living is completely abstract. It's human-driven. And at that point, I don't have complete faith in the human idea. I think, like, going back to the even playing field of differences, I highly admire the orcas, you know? And I don't think I'm that much better than the orcas, you know? Like, and so, like, why would I value the reasonable way to live, which is the societal way? You know, why would I value that above any other way, which could be one that I could build for myself, being a personal human, you know? Like,
as most humans need this society to survive.
And I think it works for a lot of people. I think a lot of people it doesn't, though. And I think that number, I wouldn't want to make any sort of forecasts on it. But I think there's a large group of people who are getting uncomfortable. You know? Anyways, can I read this to you?
Yes.
This is the one on being and nothingness. I'm going to try to speak really clearly because this is quotations. And in the future, I might be able to do an effect on it. Like a low voice effect. It says, being in nothingness. You may be asked, how did God bring forth being from nothingness? Is there not an immense difference between being and nothingness? Answer as follows. Being is in nothingness in the mode of nothingness, and nothingness is in being in the mode of being. Nothingness is being, and being is nothingness. The node of being, as it begins to emerge from nothingness into existence, is called faith. For the term faith applies neither to visible, comprehensible being, nor to nothingness, invisible and incomprehensible, but rather to the nexus of nothingness and being. Being does not stem from nothingness alone, but rather from being and nothingness together. All is one in the simplicity of absolute indifferentiation. Our limited mind cannot grasp or fathom this, for it joins infinity. It's kind of what I was expressing earlier, I feel like.
I definitely got that connection, man.
I do pretty good, don't I?
Yes.
When I might not use their words completely, but I get ideas across.
That seems definitely to reflect on what you were talking about earlier.
And those aren't my ideas. I'm not saying this is... I'm not preaching. You know, I'm approaching this, and this is a font of information of belief, and I'm saying this is highly interesting. And then there's 1,000 other different ones, and I find that beautiful, like a field of flowers. Just turn it back on. I'll fix your password. I'm wrapping up, okay? How far did we get? How do you?
Is that seconds? 1,053 seconds.
How long is that? Are we at like 20 minutes?
I think so.
Let's try to wrap it up. I had one more thing I wanted to go through, and then we can wrap it up and say goodbyes. But it'll be fun to listen to it. Maybe put on the speakers. If that's not too weird. I want to like hear it. Is that weird?
No, not at all.
There was one thing that was really, really cool. I wish I could find the one. This one was really pretty. I put this one on Facebook. Ein Sof does not abide being known, does not produce end or beginning. Primordial nothingness brought forth beginning and end. Who is beginning? The highest point, beginning of all. The concealed one, abiding in thought. It also engenders end, the culmination of the word. But there, no end, no desire, no lights, no sparks in that infinity. All these lights and sparks are dependent on it but cannot comprehend. The only one who knows, yet without knowing, is the highest desire, concealed of all concealed, nothingness. And when the highest point in the world that is coming ascend, they only know the aroma, as one inhaling an aroma is sweetened. And that's that feeling I was describing at the pit of a psychedelic journey. Buddy, you need to calm down. You've been playing for a while. Go away. You're interrupting me. That's not how you get things. Go away, please. You're loud. This thing picks up everything. I'm serious. All right, last one. Lots of quotes. I'm going to read a lot of bullshit on this show. Please be quiet. In the beginning, Ein Sof emanated 10 Sephirot, which are of its essence, united with it. It is they are entirely one. There is no change or division in the emanator that would justify saying it is divided into parts in these various Sephirot. Division and change do not apply to it, only to the external Sephirot. To help you conceive this, imagine water flowing through vessels of different colors, white, red, green, and so forth. As the water spreads through those vessels, it appears to change into the colors of the vessels, though the water is devoid of all color. The change in color does not affect the water itself, just our perception of the water. So it is with the Sephirot. They are vessels, known, for example, as Hesed, Gevurah, and Tiferet, each colored according to its function, white, red, and green, respectively, while the light of the emanator, their essence, is the water, having no color at all. This essence does not change it until it appears to change as it flows through the vessels. Better yet, imagine a ray of sunlight shining through a stained glass window of 10 different colors. The sunlight possesses no color at all, but appears to change hue as it passes through the different colors of glass. Colored light radiates through the window. The light has not essentially changed, though it seems to the viewer. Just so with the Sephirot. The light that clothed itself in the vessels of the Sephirot is its essence, like the ray of sunlight. That essence does not change color at all, neither judgment nor compassion, neither right nor left. Yet by emanating through the Sephirot, the variegated stained glass, judgment or compassion prevails.
Beautiful.
That one hit me too. Those are my favorites. All right, let's wrap it up so I can make my kid dinner. So, this was wonderful. I hope that it worked. Maybe I might just be candid and just try to drop this somewhere. You know, if you're listening to this, I appreciate you. If you stuck with me this long, I've been wanting to do this for a really long time. It's really important for me to try to get my voice heard, and I mean well. And I'm really happy that I had Mr. Calvin here with me today. He helped me set up all this, and I could not have gotten through all this technology stuff easily without his assistance. So I appreciate you, my friend. Thank you for hanging out. And como si, como da. You got anything to say? Do you have anything to say or to self-advertise? I know you have something that you have here in town. If anybody does listen to it, it's going to be a local person. So do you want to say anything about your bin that you sell stuff at and how you work and what you make? You want to give a brief little thing about that real quick?
Well, I'm a woodworker and a painter and sometimes a musician, but pretty much the only thing I have out there for the world to see is my showcase at the American Classics Marketplace. But I'm glad I was able to help set up these
Tell them
sounds.
how you turn these things. Tell them the device.
Oh yeah, these are lathe turned pens and other gifts that are cylindrical in shape because they are made on the lathe. Which means like a, to spin it at a 3,000 RPM while I shape it with
It's like putting a banana on a drill and then that drill's spinning really fast and he like chisels the banana into shape, which is really fucking cool. It's like spinning a pot on steroids, basically.
It's a little bit like pottery work, yes, except you are removing material instead of adding material.
Yes, it was pretty damn cool still. And he's an amazing artist and amazing painter. And thank you. Thank you. You'll be on here again. We'll do some more shit. Bye!